This is Rob Long with Martini Shot for The Ankler. I have a friend who is having financial trouble, and he told me that one of the things he's noticed about himself, and he's a fairly practical, no-nonsense person, is that he's spending a lot of time daydreaming about money, like winning the lottery or finding a lot of cash somewhere or having some rich foreigner hit him with a car and getting a huge settlement, which seems like a very complicated needle to thread. Now, the really strange thing he told me, as if that wasn't strange, was that he's always daydreaming about huge windfalls. I mean, his current financial straits aren't all that dire. He's not going to lose his house or anything, but he's unable to fantasize realistically about somehow getting just the figure that would put him right, about a modest tax refund or an unexpected royalty check, something realistic and quite possible. Instead, it's always, you know, piles of cash and oversized checks and cars driven by Middle Eastern princes, which clip him enough to rain money, but not enough for sad online tributes. Is this normal? He asked. Well, everybody daydreams about the lottery, I told him, unhelpfully adding that the other stuff he fantasizes about is disturbing and weird. Daydreaming about being hit by a car because of the resulting insurance settlement is, I told him, something he really does need to bring up with a licensed mental health care practitioner. The truth is, I was the wrong friend to be offering advice. I don't like to talk about money, especially with close friends. I follow the inflexible Episcopalian rule about never discussing personal financial matters with anyone but a certified public accountant, and even then, it's best to couch things in vague and non-specific terms. My people tend to keep things to themselves. We suffer in silence. We avoid the hot topics. You maybe have heard the old joke, how'd you get an Episcopalian to look at his shoes? You mentioned Jesus or money. Now, the problem is, it's impossible to talk about money without talking about how some people spend it. And it's impossible to talk about that without getting into difficult and awkward subjects like prudence and foresight and good planning and smart values. All of the things that close, dear friends should never, ever discuss with each other. Now, my friend is a successful person with a flourishing career, but he just spends too much money, in my opinion, on frivolous, to me, nonsense, again, per me, and ends up stressed out and frantic because he doesn't have the discipline, in my judgment, to curb his foolishness, as I see it, spending. Now, none of that I could say to him because a conversation about money is a minefield where friendships go to explode. Also, I mean, I work in Hollywood. I'm in no position to lecture anybody about financial prudence. When I got my first job as a television writer, I was 24 years old, and I drove a 15-year-old Subaru. It was electric blue in the places where it wasn't spotted by rust, and it emitted an alarming noise every time I made a left turn. But, you know, on the other hand, it was super cheap. But driving onto the prosperous, sun-baked Paramount Studios backlot, I was acutely aware that my rusted heap of screeching metal was ill-suited to the dazzling array of luxury cars around it. People, in fact, gave me nasty looks as I drove by. My coworkers complained if I parked my car too close to theirs, as if an unfashionable car brand might infect their BMW with some form of, you know, car COVID. Eventually, of course, I bought a fancy car. I blamed it on peer pressure, but we all know what was up. I was making real money in a status-obsessed business, in a prestige-conscious town, and I wanted to cruise around in a sleek machine that I presumed befitted my station. But once you make that mental adjustment, though, that expensive things project power and importance, once you do that, you need to keep buying expensive things. Cars, houses, seats on an airplane, and then suddenly you can't button your shirt cuff because the watch you're wearing is the size of a grapefruit, because the rule is the more money you make, the more you spend. And as everybody knows, the more you spend, the more you have to make, until you discover that you're working simply to maintain a certain level of spending and that you're unable to stop, which is when you start having daydreams about a Saudi diplomat clipping you at an intersection and paying you for your trouble with a suitcase full of cash, which is a lot harder to orchestrate than simply wearing a Timex. I didn't say any of this, obviously. I was too busy looking at my shoes. But for a lot of us in show business, the way we think about money, the way we handle it, the way we spend it, it's sort of a fractal for the business as a whole. Spending for status things, getting caught in the car upgrade current, this is a personal way of keeping the money flow flowing. Keep moving, keep buying, keep the whole system going. That's how a lot of us think and work in show business. We argue and wrangle and even sue people over back-end profits and pieces of the future downstream pie, but the truth is, that is not how we really do our business. We do it for the now. Pay me now. Spend it now. Figure it out later. The most important thing is to keep the river flowing. And that, as I said, is a fractal of how the business goes as a whole, where most of us are just trying to get something started. And once it's started, to keep it going, to keep the production orders coming. And we'll say pretty much anything and promise the world to keep that all in motion. I went to a lunch once hosted by a very high up there studio executive who works with a lot of writers. It was a small lunch. I was seated next to a visiting college professor. "Tell me," he asked, "how does the whole TV business work?" Which, you know, is a very complicated question, because the real answer is not very well, but it isn't really what the dean was asking me. What he was asking me, it turned out, was where exactly do writers rank in the TV power hierarchy? So I told him, we're like eunuchs in the Ottoman Empire. We are incredibly powerful, totally indispensable, very well compensated, missing a couple of items. And I told him ultimately what I tell everyone who asks that question, that the key to understanding the TV business or Hollywood in general is in grasping the weird, inefficient quirk that puts writers, cranky, paranoid writers, lazy, shiftless, BS artist writers, profligate, don't understand money writers, actually in charge of things. Well, you know, not in charge, but a lot more powerful than their counterparts in the feature film realm. Central, anyway, to things like casting and set construction, time management, and of course, money. And that obviously led to more questions from him, like how do you sit there and listen to idiotic notes, or how do you get budget overruns approved, and how basically do you as a writer and an executive producer manage a process so personal and complicated and Byzantine and expensive? So I told him that a great budgetary trick is to promise to do what we call a bottle show in one of the early episodes. And a bottle show is a show shot entirely on existing sets with no guest cast, with as few setups as possible, results in tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars of savings. And if the show is successful, no one will ever hold you to that promise. And if the show is canceled, the promise is moot anyway. But the moment you promise it, the budget heat comes off. You can go back to keeping things moving. You can figure out the money and the overruns later. Halfway through my Cobb salad, I realized that as closely as the dean was listening, my studio executive host was listening closer. I only caught the tail end of that, he said, but I get the feeling I should have been listening to the whole thing. I was just goofing around, I said childishly, because all studio executives think all writers are children, and sometimes that works in our favor. But, you know, what I should have done is just repeated the whole thing, gotten it all aired out. How we deal with series budget issues is how we deal with car leases and personal spending. We're just trying to keep it going. We're just trying to get the bad vibes to stop and the good vibes to continue. We're trying to keep getting to make shows and getting paid and not really thinking about what economists call creating value or what shareholders call making a profit. Now, I don't know if this next story is true or false, but I like it too much to care. When famous Mercurial film director Orson Welles was in a difficult moment in his career, he executed a neat little budget trick. Now, over the years, he had developed a reputation for being unreliable. His movies sometimes remained unfinished. His attentions would wander. And on one or two occasions, his budget overruns were truly astronomical. So by the late 1950s, he found it almost impossible to get financial backing for his pictures. But, you know, even back in those days, before the world was swimming in hedge fund billionaires and people desperate to be in the entertainment business and streaming services spending crazy cash, you could almost always find a willing investor. The term investor here is roughly equivalent to what con artists and swindlers call a mark. Welles did, in fact, find a mark. In this case, his mark was a studio, it often is. And that meant that they were already wary of Welles' reputation. Now, the picture was called Touch of Evil, and it was supposed to be a cheap little noir thriller, but Welles, of course, had other ideas. He planned and executed a remarkable opening sequence. 12 minutes of high tension, filmed entirely in one take. It remains a remarkable and virtuoso piece of movie making. You gotta see it if you haven't seen it. He shot it all in Venice, by the way, on Windward. But the sequence took almost 10 pages of the script. But Welles wanted it that way. He spread the descriptions and the actions across all of those pages to misdirect the studio, because he didn't tell his studio minders what he was up to, that the first 10 pages of the script were going to be shot in one continuous take, that he would dispense with almost 10% of the script in one day's work. So when the studio heard back from the set that Welles had wrapped for the day with an amazing 10 pages completed, they relaxed. They let him get on with his work. They kept it all going. Welles had delivered, essentially, a bottle show. Or so the legend goes, but as I said, even if it's not true, it should be true, and that's more than enough for me. Now, Touch of Evil, the movie, was not a success, really. And in that respect, it's another fractal of how the business works. You do everything you can to get the project underway and moving forward, and you don't think too much about how it's all going to turn out, because by that time, you and everyone else have been paid. You and the American Express Company are in happy agreement. The City National Bank Home Finance Department is no longer calling you. There's an old Arab phrase for this. They call it haraka baraka, or I guess al-haraka baraka. I don't speak Arabic because I took an intro class in it once in college, and it seemed, frankly, way too hard, so I dropped it immediately. But haraka baraka means, basically, movement is blessing. And people use it to describe the joy of physical movement and the need to keep learning and exploring and, you know, good things like that. But it also means the hustle, the noisy back and forth in the marketplace, the keep it all going and keep it all moving at all costs. The bottle show, basically. The 10 pages in one night trick. Show business, in other words. Haraka baraka. That's how show business works and works best. We talk and sell and spend and borrow and promise and haraka baraka our way into script orders and series on the air and feature film green lights and shareholder conference calls. How we in show business spend our money, how we spend money on production, how we spend money as companies and publicly traded corporate entities, it's all sort of the same way. It's all sort of haraka baraka. Movement is blessing. We'll figure it out later. But then, you know, later comes. Later always comes. And we're sort of where we are now in show business, with productions canceled and the business wondering what's next, and companies paralyzed by rumors of buyouts and mergers and downsizing, when all we really need is some haraka baraka. And that's it for this week. Next week, we'll fail. For The Ankler, this is Rob Long with Martini Shot.